Wieners. It's the Walk Wieners. It's the Walk Wieners.
Welcome to Award Wieners. I'm your co-host, John, joined by my brother-at-arms, David. This is our night at the Oscars, where we watch Oscar-winning movies while enjoying Oscar Mayer Wieners. It's a celebration of American culinary and cinematic pop culture. In this episode, we discuss the Vietnam War drama, The Deer Hunter, winner of the 1978 Oscar for Best Picture. Dave, what's going on?
There's not much going on. You know, New York's still in quarantine. We're hitting phase four soon. As I've talked about previously on the podcast, I'm having a hard time concentrating. I haven't seen a lot of new movies, and the movies I have seen, it's taken me a long time to get through. I saw Palm Springs, which is on Hulu, and it's done by The Lonely Island, which is Andy Samberg's group. I highly recommend it. I don't want to spoil it. It's goofy and weird, and it's a romance comedy, so I would check it out. That's the best movie I've seen in the last probably 4 weeks.
Lonely Island is the I'm in a boat song and Dick in a Box.
Yeah, I maybe throw it on the ground as well.
And Do It Like a Boss.
What have you been up to?
A lot of flipping through Netflix and not settling on anything. So I spent a lot of my time on the Netflix menu, not a lot of time watching things. I did watch the documentary You Don't Know Me, kind of another look at the movie Showgirls and how we all missed the point of it when it first came out. They look at the director's body of work, Paul Verhoeven, I think. His other movies are violent satire, so it's Total Recall, Starship Troopers, and there's a few other movies that he did. Basically, they did the same thing with sex, like a satire about bad romance movies, and everyone missed the point, and everyone just got offended by like the amount of nudity in it and the bad acting, which is also intentional. It's actually like a really academic study on a terrible movie. Check it out. It's fun. I think you have to probably rent it.
Are you saying it's too smart? It's too meta for the general audience?
You mean Showgirls itself?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that's his film. So like even Starship Trooper is a huge satire where the humans are the bad guys. We follow the bad guys in the film.
Or a fascist army. I'm doing my part. Are you?
Well, that's how I'm going to get citizenship.
Okay. So today we're watching The Deer Hunter. Dave, remind us why we're watching The Deer Hunter.
Way back in the olden days.
Yeah. Pre-COVID times.
Earlier this year. We did our Academy Award contest, and the person who got the most correct answers got to pick our next movie. We pushed it out a couple of times because we were stressed, because it's been a difficult time in the world, and we were waiting for a new release of the Blu-ray. Now we're finally doing it. This is for my sister-in-law, Sam, who won the contest. Not only did she win, she called it out. She sent me a text. She's like, I'm winning this year. And then she went ahead and did it.
She was like Babe Ruth at the plate, pointing to where she was going to hit her home run.
I wanted to chat a little bit about our trepidation to do this. We've pushed it off a couple times. I was really hesitant to do this because it was in my mind a downer of a film. I've seen this previously. Mm-hmm. There was a weekend where I watched it with my brother. I just wasn't into watching a movie about
torture.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Even before we watched this film, we had another discussion about pushing it off again and trying to do something fun because we're just like, these movies are stressful.
It's just the time. Everything sucks. COVID, we're dealing with a lot of race relation issues in America. A president who doesn't seem to care about these things. Everything is kind of going wrong at once, it feels like.
Yeah.
This was like an additional layer of stress that we didn't necessarily want because you and I just use movies as escapism. This seemed very, very dark.
And it was, but not as bad as I thought it was going to be, honestly.
I agree. I think I overhyped it. But I also read more about it, and after I read more about it, it seemed not as serious. And we'll get into why in a few minutes.
There's so many wild stories about this movie. I guess we should describe this film before we go on, and I'm going to let you do that.
I say the movie's about a group of friends from a small steel town that are sent to fight in the Vietnam War, and then they deal with what happened to them when they return. Moving on to the red carpet. If you're a first-time listener, you should know that we eat movie-themed hot dogs while watching these movies. David, how was your hot dog dressed on the red carpet this evening?
I didn't ultimately do this. So my initial thought was just to take venison sausage, put it in the microwave on, you know, high for X number of minutes until it explodes. And that would have been my The Deer Hunter hot dog.
To amp it up, you could do like microwave Russian roulette where you put it on for like 2 minutes and then see what happens. And like maybe just spin the dial if you have got to spin the dial microwave and see if it explodes at certain times.
Yeah, that's pretty dark. I'll be frank. I told my friend about that.
And You'll be frank. Hot
dog. That wasn't intended. I told my friend about it and he was like, dude, what's wrong with you? So I ended up making a different hot dog. I made a Twinkie hot dog with mustard. So I cut two Twinkies down the middle, put a hot dog in it, covered it in mustard, and took a bite.
How does that tie to the movie? Because that just sounds so random.
So there is a scene in the movie for one of the main characters who's a bit drunk, dips a Twinkie into mustard.
Yeah, there's a jar of mustard. Goes
he goes ham?
Goes ham on it, yeah.
It is disgusting. I would not recommend it. I do have a video of myself taking it. I'll put it up on the Instagram. It's not good. Is it as bad as the champagne hot dog from last episode? Yeah, it is. It's bad. I've had some real bad ones recently. But I want to give you another little bonus here. So have you ever seen UHF?
A long time ago.
Yeah, so that's a movie with Weird Al. And there's a scene in it where one of the characters puts a hot dog on a Twinkie and covers it in Cheese Whiz and eats it. I decided to do two for one. So I did the same thing, but I couldn't find easy cheese, like the stuff that comes out of the can. So I found some Cheese Whiz and I tried that. If I had to compare the Deer Hunter hot dog to my UHF hot dog, I'm going UHF hot dog all the way. The mustard is just horrible with Twinkies.
I tried that also. I just put a little mustard on a Twinkie. And the first attempt was spicy brown mustard. That is gross. Somehow the cream and the mustard merge. It creates a weird texture that like travels throughout your mouth in this terrible way. Do not do that. I tried it with just regular yellow mustard, as they do in the film. I didn't think it was nearly as bad.
Oh, I thought it was terrible.
That's not like my go-to, but it was tolerable.
I mean, here's the thing I kept thinking to myself when I was watching the movie. I was like, honey mustard exists, right? Like, you can do a sweet and tangy, spicy mustard. But there's just something about the cream and the mustard for me that did not work together.
Yeah, I agree. I also found out that I still like Twinkies. I hadn't had one in probably 20 years.
Same. Like, oh, I opened the box and I ate two immediately. I was like, this is so much better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, they're totally fine. I probably shouldn't eat a whole box of Twinkies, but I did.
Quarantine, baby!
Also, I couldn't just find a pack of two. It was a box of 10, so.
At least there's two of me. There's Sarah and myself, and we split it.
Oh, no, I just ate them. They're great.
You're usually so health conscious. Oh,
like, sometimes you just, I don't know what to say about
that. You go
that.
A little ham?
Yeah.
What did you make?
I made a banh mi dog. There's no good reason. It doesn't really tie to the film much more than maybe location. So in Vietnam, when the French colonized it, as they did, they are colonizers, they basically merged some food cultures together. And more or less, it's some Vietnamese food, some meat, and a few other things, usually jalapeno, cilantro, some carrots, on a baguette. So I did the same thing, but replaced it with a hot dog. So I made a sriracha mayo, quick pickled some jalapenos, and just shredded some carrots, and then put some cilantro on top of that, and cucumber, actually, on a hot dog. And it turned out to be pretty good. The jalapenos were kind of spicy, even though I tried to quick pickle them to make them a little sweeter.
Do you prefer banh mi or Cubans?
They're very different, so I guess it depends on my mood. What are you thinking?
Oh, I'm thinking I'm going to make you answer this question. It's either or. Then I'll answer it.
It's either or?
Yeah.
Like, what would I probably want more often? Probably banh mi.
I think that's my choice as well. I think I prefer the banh mi over the Cuban. Not that the Cuban isn't great, but when I eat a Cuban, it's like I eat half of it, then I take a nap. Little off track. I just, you know, in my head, those were somewhat related because it's a bunch of meat stacked on bread, but I guess that's any sandwich.
That's literally the definition of a sandwich. So,
okay. I'm ready to talk about food facts.
Okay. I actually have a Twinkie here. I'm going to eat this as you talk tell about, me about Twinkies.
Yeah. So we're talking about Twinkies today. So I just looked up some articles and this will be fun. So the Twinkie was invented in 1930 by James Alexander DeWar. And he was a Canadian-born baker for the Continental Baking Company.
How did that become Hostess?
They were purchased. The company was just purchased. That's not a great story. Anyway, so I want to talk about the name. The name came from Richie Koph, K-O-P-H. And he said that he was driving through St. Louis and saw a billboard for the Twinkle Toe Shoes, and then he just named them the Twinkies.
Were those the precursor to L.A. Lights?
Probably, definitely. And here's like actually the most interesting stuff about this. They were originally banana cream filled, During World War II, they were changed to vanilla because bananas were rationed. You know, makes sense. People came back. They're like, I want the Twinkies that I had over in Europe.
Over there?
Which were vanilla filled.
Do you think you would like a banana Twinkie?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would definitely like a banana Twinkie.
I am not sure. It could go either way.
Yeah. Well, we can find them. They're now in existence again. So I'll explain that.
I had no idea.
They would come back for promotions, but they weren't a regular rotation. And from what I understand is that in 2005, as part of a promotion for King Kong, a banana flavored Twinkie was reintroduced and it was very popular. And they decided to just keep it in rotation after that. So King Kong saved the banana Twinkie. That seems a little on the nose now that I look back on it. There's this myth that Twinkies can last forever. It's a myth. It looks like they can last about 45 days on the shelf. So,
okay.
Yeah, don't put them in your rations for the end times, which could be next week. Twinkie the Kid is the mascot, and that is an anthropomorphic Twinkie cowboy. And it's really ridiculous. I have no like point about it other than it looks absolutely insane, and I kind of love it.
How do we think that even came to be?
I don't fucking know. It came out in war, like before World War II, and they're like, oh, people like cowboys, put the Twinkie with a cowboy hat. Like, today, what would it be? Twinkie with some wraparound sunglasses? Like, I mean, in the 90s, they would have been a Twinkie with wraparound sunglasses. Yeah, a skateboard or some rollerblades. But today, it would be like TikTok star. This is the final bit of trivia. And hopefully you haven't read this, John, but if you have, it's okay. What is the world record for eating Twinkies in 6 minutes?
Well, I did read this, but I would have no idea otherwise. Okay. I mean, if I were to guess, not knowing this number now that I've already seen it, well, 6 minutes might throw me off. But what, Joey Chestnut ate like 70 hot dogs in 10 minutes. And I feel like these are a lot smaller and lighter. So I feel like he could easily crush, you know, more than 70 of those in 6 minutes.
I mean, you're correct, but you're still off. So Joey Chestnut, who won the hot dog eating contest this year, setting a world record, by the way, he ate 121 Twinkies in 6 minutes.
I wonder how many I could eat, because I'm pretty sure I could crush that box of 10 in a few minutes, because I just had that one in like seconds, basically. They're very light. They're not like a dense food, and they don't taste bad. I bet I could crush 20 of those in 6 minutes.
I don't know. I think I might throw up after the first box. It's just too sweet. I don't eat all that much sweet stuff. I just barf everywhere. It'd be horrible.
I'm not saying I would enjoy it, but I maybe 20 is too many. I don't know.
I'm capping myself at a box. I'm not playing this game. And so here's another question for you. We talked about Twinkies. We generally like them. What is your favorite Hostess dessert?
I think I like the Hostess cupcakes, the chocolate ones with the cream filling inside and the little swirl on top.
Yeah, those are really good.
What about you?
I really love Ho-Hos. Absolutely love Ho-Hos. And I also like, I think these are by Hostess, but Nutter Butters. Are Nutter Butters by Hostess?
No, that was not Betty Crocker, but there was a woman on the front of that thing. I don't think it was Hostess. I know what you're talking about, though.
Anyway, love me some Ho-Hos. After I got the Twinkies and for this podcast, I was like, oh, I should go back and buy Ho-Hos. And I had to stop myself because then I would have just a bunch of sweets in the house.
Where do they come up with these names? Twinkie, Ho-Ho, Ding Dong. All of these sound like sex acts.
They probably are. They're like probably men in the 1930s like, oh, look at this double entendre. I'm so clever.
Even Snowball. Like Snowball is another.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, you're right.
Actually, I do like the Hostess Snowballs too, I have to say, if you're familiar with those.
Yeah, I am. I don't particularly like those, but you know, you do your thing.
Exactly. Okay. We have some movie facts. This movie was released December 8th, 1978. Its runtime is 184 minutes. Budget, $15 million, and the box office haul was $49 million. It was directed by Michael Cimino. And this was by far his biggest success in the box office. Almost all his other box office films were bombs. His last film pulled in $21,000 on a $31 million budget. And then he retired after that one. He's a really weird guy. So he lied about a lot of things, claimed to be attached to a Green Beret medical unit in Vietnam. This was disproved. There are some conflicting stories. He did at most 6 months as a reservist. And never deployed. He was sort of in the military. He also lied about his age a lot, often saying he was 10 years younger than he actually was. And if you see a picture of him, this probably makes sense. He had a lot of plastic surgery. I would say almost to the Michael Jackson level. Clearly, he was uncomfortable with himself in many ways. I wonder if his quote-unquote retirement was his best way of saving face. Kind of a really weird guy. I don't know if you read any more about him.
I read a little bit. You've read more, but my impression, like, I clearly don't actually know this guy. It seems like he just has a lot of anxiety issues, and he just wasn't cut out for being a director.
So he was originally a commercial director, and I don't know why he transitioned into movies. I don't know. Like, he seemed vain, not in like an evil or mean way, but just vanity drove him to do a lot of these weird things. We don't really have to get into that because I don't know much more about him other than there's a lot of things that he said were pretty much disproved.
Yeah, it's okay.
We'll probably get into that a little bit every now and again in the movie as we talk more about it. This movie, The Deer Hunter, was nominated for 9 Oscars and won 5, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting Actor for Christopher Walken, Best Sound, and Best, that can't be right, Best Editing. Best File Editing. Probably Best Film Editing. Best film editing. I was like, what?
These files, they did real good.
Yeah, they did great. Okay, this movie went up against Coming Home, Heaven Can Wait, Midnight Express, and An Unmarried Woman. Dave, have you seen any of these movies?
No, but I've heard of Midnight Express and Coming Home.
So Midnight Express is a similar film. It's about a guy who gets caught smuggling drugs in Turkey and ends up in a Turkish prison. So if anyone ever makes the comment, oh, it's better than a Turkish prison, it probably comes from Midnight Express. And Heaven Can Wait is a Warren Beatty film where he accidentally is taken to heaven before he's supposed to die. It's sort of a comedy where they try to then find a new body for him because his other body's already been cremated by the time they catch the mistake.
So weird.
If we want to spoil things, I think The Deer Hunter was by far better than the other movies I'd seen this year.
All right.
Other films that came out this year, Superman, Grease, Animal House, Every Which Way But Loose, Halloween, and The Wiz.
The Wiz.
Speaking of Michael Jackson, yeah.
I've seen every one of those films. Have you seen all of those?
I don't know if I've seen every one of those films. It's a fair amount of them.
I think people don't understand how influential Animal House was. Remember when we were doing our research for Marty? They talked about Animal House in that research and about how it influenced how people viewed college.
I'm a little confused because Marty came out 20 years before Animal House.
So we were reading about hookup culture.
Oh, right. Okay.
Like, we're reading about hookup culture, and hookup culture went through different phases, and the latter phases, Animal House greatly influenced our college culture today.
Or just brought it to attention, because it seemed like that was already happening, but maybe not talked about.
Does he eat a Twinkie with one bite in that film? He might.
I don't know.
Anyway.
Other notes on the Oscars for this year. Warren Beatty was the first person to earn nomination for acting, directing, producing, and screenwriting, all for the same film, Heaven Can Wait. All right, movie trivia.
This film is based in part on an unproduced screenplay called The Man Who Came to Play. The script was obviously rewritten, and the original script was about Vegas and Russian roulette. So they were like, oh, we like Russian roulette. They just pulled it out, plopped in Vietnam, and smacked them together.
Perfect.
So John Cazale, he played Stanley in this film. He began this film while sick. You know, he died of cancer. The director knew he was sick when he was starting, but the studio didn't know. And when they found out, they wanted to replace him. And Meryl Streep learned of their intentions, and she threatened to quit if they did. Cazale died shortly after filming this movie, and he never saw the completed version of it. And finally, I just wanted to mention, you know, Streep and Cazale were romantically involved at the time, and he was about a decade her senior. They had met at a play in New York.
I think the other note here is that the studio, they agreed to allow him to be in the film with the stipulation that if he died during filming, he would be written out of the film.
When this film was first shown at the Berlin Film Festival in 1979, the Soviet delegation walked out in protest against the way the film portrayed the people of Vietnam. The ensuing domino effect led to walkouts by Cubans, East Germans, Bulgarians, Poles, and Czechoslovakians. And then two members of the jury also resigned.
So all the communist countries
were like, peace out. I have some actor facts as well, if you're ready.
I'm ready.
Oh, good. Great. Yeah. Christopher Walken. Yeah, he's in this movie. He is baby-faced. He won Best Supporting Actor for his role in this film. And he is known for The Dead Zone, A View to Kill, Batman Returns, Sleepy Hollow, the Prophecy films, Weapon of Choice by Fat Boy Slim. And that is a music video. I love that video. It's when he's dancing around and you know, doing all that stuff.
And the cowbell.
He did a ton of stuff on Saturday Night Live. The Concierge, I think. The thing about him is he studied dance. So the Fat Boy Slim video was him dancing because he studied dance. I really, really dig him. I feel like he is a latter-day version of Nicolas Cage, if you know what I mean.
I think you're overselling Nicolas Cage.
Really? Really? I mean, Nicolas Cage is a great actor. You just have to know how to use him. He's like a strong spice.
Okay.
This is my favorite bit about him, is that he was considered for the Han Solo role in Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And John, can you give me an impression of Walken doing a Han Solo line?
I can only think of like one Han Solo line, and that's when he's being frozen in carbonite. So imagine Princess Leia saying to me, I love you.
I can do it. Hold on. Okay. I love you.
Like a Walken pause. I know.
Okay. Let me do one. Never tell me the odds.
Oh, that's good. That's a good one.
I had a little more time to think about that one.
Okay.
Okay. Meryl Streep is up. We're not going to do a ton about Meryl Streep because she was in Kramer for Kramer, and we're going to cover that movie fully. So I just want to mention a few things. She was nominated for Best Supporting Actress in this film. This was her first nomination. She now has 21 noms, and she has won 3 of them. And she got an MFA from Yale. Next up is Robert De Niro. And we covered old Bobby Milk in the Godfather 2 episode. We're back up to Johnny Cazale. Again, we talked about him as in both the Godfather episodes. He played Fredo. And you can learn more about him if you listen to them. Needless to say, he was a very influential actor for someone who had only a couple credits to his name. There's a documentary about him, and there are a lot of actors who point to him saying, you know, we studied him to learn our craft.
I think he and Robert De Niro were good friends. They did a lot of movies together.
Okay, so let's dive right into the movie recap. We open up in a steel mill outside of Pittsburgh in the early 1970s. We're introduced to a group of friends who are getting off their night shift. And they are Michael, played by De Niro, and he seems like the leader of their group. He's intensely focused. There's Steven, played by John Savage. He's getting married later that day, and he seems like a nice enough guy, but maybe not that bright. There is Nick, played by Walken, and he's Michael's best friend and roommate. There is Stanley, by Cazale. He isn't going to Vietnam. I should mention that Michael, Steven, and Nick are all going to Vietnam. But he is a tough guy, but he's really not all that tough. I would say he exemplifies toxic masculinity. And there's a few other guys around, but we don't really need to worry about them.
So that's like the core group of friends in the film. A couple notes on the scene. I did listen to the commentary. The factory we see at the beginning, they're kind of smelting steel. The factory actually trained the actors on how to do these things. There's no way that would be allowed today for insurance reasons, safety, all that stuff.
In the 70s, you could do whatever you wanted. Rules didn't apply. Are you kidding me? So I wanted to make a note that it feels like high school. They're just all getting ready to go out and have a good time. This feels to me like they're establishing these characters as being young and innocent, maybe, because they're just ready to party. They have a lot of zest for life.
This first act is centered around the lives of these men in the small town that they live in. The scenes are kind of chaotic. It really feels that they were kind of loosely put together, and to some degree they were. The director had a lot of scenes shot over and over and over, kind of just waiting for little accidents to happen that seemed real. A lot of these extras and things like that happening, they feel real because they are real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting take. Probably very expensive too.
After these guys get off work, they get into Michael's car. So they're all carpooling together. And as they drive off, they see this big truck kind of taking up a large portion of the road. And they bet him that he cannot pass this truck on the right side of the road. And he makes a daring move in the car and passes the truck. And then as soon as he gets past it, he takes a hard left in front of it and basically spins the car around and parks it on the other side of the street. And I think this shows how they're willing to take calculated risks, or at least Michael is. And he's very competent in many ways. It's showing he's a little bit daring, but he can do these things because he knows he can. And I think that'll come into play later. And then listening to the commentary, De Niro actually did the driving in the scene. There were no stunt drivers. And he actually drove that car with no clearance on either side of him around that truck with all those guys in the car with them.
There's so many crazy stories from the 70s in De Niro. He's just like, I'll do it. Fuck it.
Basically, pretty much all of the cast members did their own stunts in the film. Even jumping out of helicopters and climbing on those helicopters. It was all the actors actually doing that.
You're absolutely hit the nail on the head that this does set up all the later scenes because De Niro knows the odds. He's willing to bet. He's willing to risk things.
In a controlled manner. Like, he knows that he's still in control.
Yeah, exactly.
They go to a bar. That's where they're headed in their commute home. And they start drinking to celebrate Steve's wedding. He's getting married later that day. There's the scene where all the guys are in the bar. It's only guys in the bar. And they start singing, I Love You, Baby. What do you think this scene and song represents to this crew?
I think it represents their love and camaraderie for each other. These are people who've grown up together their entire lives. They went to high school, they went to grade school, they're working together. They know everything about each other. They love each other. And it's sort of their innocence in a way. You know, they, while they're working class, while they are doing all these things, they're kind of young, and they really haven't experienced much outside of, you know, drinking and having a good time and hanging out and working.
I think it also shows they have the safety net too of this crew of people, and they're there for each other, but they're about to ship off to Vietnam, which we will find out in just a few minutes. Up until that point, they never had to deal with anything more stressful than a day at work.
This setup seems crazy to me because they're like, they got off work at what, 7 a.m. They went and got sauced. Like, I know that if I was getting married later that day, I would go home and sleep immediately.
I think Steven even tries to do that, but they're like, nope. And at one point, his mother shows up and drags him out of the bar.
That is truly one of my favorite scenes of this film. I love that scene. I want to describe this for the audience. The mother comes in, it's like, it's cold. You should wear a scarf tonight. And Steven's like, why would I wear a scarf with my tuxedo? I would have loved if he actually would have done that. That would have been amazing. It would have built his character so well, showing that, you know, he still loves his parents and like he ultimately acquiesces to him.
Yeah. Let's move on a little bit too, because I think we're going to get into some of this. In the next several scenes, we see this paradox of life in this town. Steven's mother is a really traditional woman. There's a lot of cuts back and forth between different plots happening that all kind of lead up to the wedding. Steven's mother is in a Russian Orthodox church speaking to the priest. She thinks her son's fiance is pregnant.
She is.
There are these juxtapositions of these traditional women preparing the wedding hall. They're all in headscarves. I would say really just conservative clothing, juxtaposed against these bridesmaids who are in bright pink dresses with like plunging decolletages and kind of screwing around. We see this also, this juxtaposition between the men and the women. Like, the men are getting drunk while the bridesmaids are kind of getting ready.
Doing the work.
There's just this clash of this old and new. So it's this like traditional old world culture that has come over here. These guys are all first generation immigrants. It seems like they are modernizing while their parents and older community members are still living in this world, which they're drifting away from slowly.
Before I forget, I wanted to talk a little bit about Angela, and that's the woman that Steven is marrying. She is pregnant. Like, I think it's pretty clear in the film that she's pregnant because she has a child later on and she's like checking her stomach. I read that the director said that Steven never slept with Angela and that he's marrying her only because no one else would, and he didn't want her to be an unwed mother.
I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah, because Steven tells Nick that he's like, I've never been with her.
Oh, I missed that.
So here's the thing, like, the director says something, that doesn't mean if it's not in the film, it's not in the film. So he could like made his mind up. He has J.K. Rowling syndrome. The director said that it was Nick's child. I think that was a bad decision. He should have said it was Stanley's child.
I think that would make more sense for Stanley's character, because they want to get across that Nick is a stand-up character in the film. Like, it makes more sense.
Yeah, it does.
For the way things are. Kind of would change your opinion of him and would maybe lessen the emotional impact of the end of the film.
Definitely. But it happened off screen, right? This is just what someone says. It could be their own headcanon. We can completely ignore it. All we know is that I think, personally, Steven is marrying this woman because she is pregnant, and which makes him a more sympathetic character than he already was.
Okay, so we're just going to ignore
what the director said. But remember, we said he lies. Like, he's just a fibber.
He's a revisionist for sure on his history and these things too. So we'll just ignore him.
Okay.
I think one other note on juxtapositions that we see in the town is the joyful drunk, I would say, who runs the bar, also sings in the church choir.
He may have been part of the Pittsburgh Steelers as a kicker. And like, it's like one line in the film. He's like, I would go with you, but I got bad knees. I think I read that that guy wasn't an actor.
Yeah, they found him in whatever town they were casting people in. Yeah, like one of those guys.
We're just going to get you drunk and you can run around and be crazy. Sounds like a great acting gig.
He totally works for the role he's in, too.
He does, 100%.
It's great. I don't know if he went on to do other things, but I kind of hope he did.
Something John something. I can't remember his last name.
John Actor.
John Actor, exactly. John Actor from Pittsburgh.
In the next scene, we see Linda, again, that's Meryl Streep, is getting ready in her bridesmaid dress. And as she dresses for the film, we also see that she's preparing a meal because she lives with her father and she takes the meal up to him. We find out that he's like drunkenly passed out on the floor. She tries to help him back up in bed, but in his drunken stupor, he's angry at a woman in his life. We're not exactly sure who. Maybe it's her mother. He slaps Linda a couple times. She leaves very, very upset, as she should be, and goes to Nick and asks if she can stay there while they're in Vietnam. He says, sure, you know, you can use the place. Feel free to do whatever you want.
Yeah, and we should note that Nick and Michael live together.
Yes. We were discussing this earlier. We weren't sure if it's like Nick's home and Michael lives there or if they own it together. We don't really know the situation, but they're definitely roommates in a double wide.
Yeah.
On a hill, which feels appropriate for the area if you've been out there.
We also learned some other things. And we learned that Nick and Linda are a couple. And then through visual cues, we learned that Michael has feelings for Linda, but doesn't act on them.
And I think she flirts back too.
Yeah, she's a really interesting, complex character that I feel like could get overlooked. Because there's a lot going on, but she never outright says how she's feeling. You have to intuit what she's doing.
The cinematographer who is doing the commentary on the film said that her role was never a big role necessarily, but that Meryl Streep did such a good job with the character that more attention was brought to these subtle moments.
If you have Meryl Streep in a movie, you got to use her. Even when she's, what, 30? I think she's probably 30 in this film. I read that people had questions about these actors' age and thinking they were too old to play characters who went to Vietnam because they were all in their 30s at this point. And John, I guess, was in his 40s. Like, did you notice that?
I took it that they were in their later 20s.
Okay.
So they could have been drafted.
Yeah, they don't go into that, do they? They don't say if they were drafted or they signed up. Like, I got the impression they signed up.
So we don't know if they're like willing volunteers or conscripted.
Yeah, and that's maybe one of the genius and problematic parts of this film. You don't know.
I mean, it would change the tune of some things and some scenes. So,
yeah, okay.
And maybe they signed up because they seem to be fairly patriotic, and there's a celebration for them in a second, which we'll talk about.
Yeah, I always assumed they signed up. I thought they were just ready to go to Vietnam. They wanted to support America.
I think that makes sense. While the men are getting ready for the wedding, they are also packing for a hunting trip. As soon as the wedding's over, these guys are going to go up to a cabin in the mountains and go hunting one last time, because several of these guys are about to head out to Vietnam, and this is probably the last time that they'll get to do this. It's also something that a few of them really enjoy. Mm-hmm. And then as Michael packs for the trip, he's both wearing his tuxedo and his camo stuff. So he's got a trucker hat on with a tuxedo and hunting boots.
It did feel a little out of place. Like
in my mind, I'm like, do you want to have hat hair at the wedding because you're wearing a trucker hat all day? That was like, I don't know, that's where my mind went.
But Michael starts talking about, you know, it's important to kill a deer with one shot, a focus precise shot.
For Christ's sake, Mike, Stevens getting married in a couple hours. I don't know what the hell we're even doing. We're talking about hunting the last time before the army. The whole thing, it's crazy.
And I'll tell you one thing. If I found out my life had to end up in the mountains, it'd be be all right.
But it has to be in your mind.
What? One shot?
Two, it's pussy. I don't think about one shot that much anymore, Mike.
You have to think about one shot. One shot is what it's all about. Deer has to be taken with one shot. I try to tell people that. They don't listen. You ever think about Vietnam?
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I'm thinking about the deer. Going on. I like the trees, you know? I like the way that the trees are in the mountains, all different. The way the trees are. Sound like some asshole, huh?
I tell you, you're the only guy I go hunting with, you know? I like a guy with quick moves and speed. I ain't gonna hunt with no assholes.
Well, who's an asshole?
Who's an asshole? Who do you think's an asshole? They're all a bunch of assholes. I mean, I love them. They're great guys, but, you know, without you, I hunt alone. Seriously, that's what I do.
But you're a fucking nut.
Not that, Mike, you're a maniac. Control freak. I just don't like no surprises.
And I wanted to really dig into this to understand what this means in the film. Have you thought about this at all, John?
I think what we're seeing here is that he is a very precise person. We did talk about that earlier. He's intense. He's focused. And I think for him, he goes in and takes care of things as efficiently as possible. He does not mess around. I think it's also him focusing on what the task in front of him. So, you know, with Vietnam, he's going to be very focused with what is going to happen there and how he's going to behave. I also think this hunting trip for him is, you know, this is his happy place. And if something happens to him in Vietnam, he wants this to be his last memory of home, or even just last memory in general, like something he can look back on that he always wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So how did you interpret that single focus, precise shot comment?
I initially read it as him being empathetic to the deer, like not wanting to do more harm than necessary. But I think your interpretation is more correct after watching the film.
I think you're right to say that too, though. I don't think that's incorrect. That is part of it too. He doesn't want anyone to suffer either. I agree with you there.
Okay. And Nick also chats about going up there, and he says he goes because he likes the trees. So they two see things very differently in the world.
Again, we have someone who's very hyper-focused and someone who lets his mind wander a little bit. I think this is foreshadowing how they are going to handle and experience Vietnam. Mm-hmm. You know, one's going to be ultra-focused, and to me that says that person will make it out of Vietnam because they're going to be attentive of everything, and the other one is going to be staring at the trees. If you're not paying attention in a war zone, something bad can happen. And that's kind of how I interpret that. What was your thought on that?
No, I think that's correct. It's more or less talking about Nick's character as being, he's just more contemplative, more of an introvert, potentially. He's not up there to hunt. He's up there because he likes to be alone and quiet and contemplate. That could be dangerous in a war situation.
I think there's also a scene here where we see Stanley, again, this shiny gazelle, looking at a broken window on a car, and we see his reflection, and he's kind of checking himself out. I think that shows some vanity, but I think there's more to this. How did you interpret that scene?
Yeah, I think he has a low ego. He is obsessed with women. He's a womanizer. And I think looking in at a broken mirror generally shows that the internal struggle with the character. He sees himself as broken, as not being fooled, not being able to garner respect. Mm-hmm. Which is why he is such a loudmouth and a braggart and doing all these masculine things. What I thought about was that he is probably scared to go to Vietnam and stayed back and then made up for that fear by being extra masculine.
The exterior is just a man who's, you know, put together to some degree because I think he does take care of himself. But the broken mirror reflects the interior where he has low self-esteem and isn't really as together as he would like to think he is. Mm-hmm. And we see that in a lot of these scenes here as just the way he acts and just how uncomfortable he is when someone pushes him a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then we cut over to the Orthodox Church, which is where the wedding takes place. The church is actually in Cleveland, Ohio. I've been there for a wedding. Just in that area of the country, so that's like Pittsburgh, Cleveland, parts of West Virginia, there's a lot of Orthodox churches there because a lot of Russian and Eastern Europeans settled there ultimately. Dave, I want to ask this question. You're from the other side of Ohio, so Cincinnati, that's 4 or 5 hours by car. It's more German and Catholic. So when you saw this Orthodox wedding and church, how did you feel about it? Like, what was your reaction?
I had no idea what was going on. I literally had not seen any of these parts of the ritual, like the crowns, the drinking out of the cups, just even the wording was different. I thought it would be more of a traditional Catholic wedding, but clearly it wasn't.
It felt foreign to you.
Yes, absolutely.
The double drinking thing I've never seen before. So as far as I know, that is something that's made up for the wedding. Maybe there's a real thing that's like, I don't know. I've not seen that. But a lot of the other things I've seen and experienced. My dad is an Orthodox priest. He's actually from the Cleveland area. He actually knew the priest who played in the movie. That was a real Orthodox priest. That was actually the priest of that church.
Nice.
Maybe three more connections than me and Kevin Bacon are friends.
So. I mean, we could probably get the Kevin Bacon from here. Definitely 100% so. You get the Kevin Bacon from here.
And I also can't help watching this that could have been my dad shipping off to Vietnam from the same area, same background, or even us if we had been born at a different time.
You bring that up, but like, how does that make you feel? Does it make you feel trepidation, worried?
We don't have to deal with that. So we were lucky in many capacities, and now we're too damn old to be in the Army.
And I have a torn MCL. I thought about that too, and I've thought about a lot about this. We were old enough to go to Iraq. Oh no, Afghanistan.
Both.
It's hard for us and difficult for us to understand the mentality of the draft. We weren't associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
We could have gone or we could not have gone, but there wasn't this patriotic push to get people to go. We want to switch back to some more fun things, if there's much fun in this movie. So this wedding is a joyous occasion. There's a lot of fun going on. People are drinking, people are dancing. The reception is held at the VFW, which is also honoring the men in the wedding who are going off to Vietnam. And again, you know, this film is somewhat chaotic. There's a lot of cuts between what's happening, jumping around the 5 or 6 different characters. And so here's some things that happen. Michael looks on from the edge of the room where he and Linda continuously lock eyes. They got a little bit of a flirt on. Nick notices this, but, you know, it doesn't make him uncomfortable. I feel like this is a long ongoing thing in their relationship. So, John, what do you think is going on with Linda right now?
She's committed to Nick. There's even a scene where Michael asks her, do you like Nick? And she says yes. And then I think at that point, he just decides to back off because I don't think Michael wants to cause any tension, but I think he likes her also because she seems to be someone special, if that makes sense, like a standout in the town. And maybe Michael realizes that she's the best thing in the area and he doesn't want to miss out on that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I mean, for me, when looking at her, I feel like she doesn't want to be in an abusive relationship with her father and sees Nick as a way out of that situation.
I mean, I think she likes Nick too.
Yeah, it doesn't discount that. Yeah. We see some Boilermakers. Everyone knows what a Boilermaker is. Do you? I don't remember, actually.
Whiskey and beer.
Ooh, tasty. Whiskey and beer. You drop the whiskey in the beer and drink it?
Beer cocktail.
Beer. That's true. It is a beer cocktail.
It is a beer cocktail.
I haven't done a Boilermaker in a very long time. I'm probably not going to do one anytime soon. One of my favorite scenes in this movie is in this section, and that is when Nick, played by Walken, is fake jumping over a glass of beer, and the crowd keeps going wild when he does it, because like he runs up to the glass and stops, and like he looks like he's scared, and he runs back, and he keeps does it over and over until he like takes a tiny little hop over it, and everyone goes crazy. Great scene. Absolutely. I love it. Nick's a great character in this.
Mm-hmm.
We see some not-so-joyous things. Back to Stanley, that creep. We see that the DJ grabs his girlfriend's ass while dancing. Stanley punches his girlfriend or his date to the wedding.
What the hell? Why didn't he punch the DJ?
Because he's a coward. I mean, that's his character. He's just a child.
The other half of this is that when she comes to, they're just fine with it. They're like, yeah, that's life.
That's life in small town, I guess. Because no one stepped in to say anything or do anything. That's what blew my mind. I mean, Nick stepped in to break them up, but like, if that would happen now, that guy would get his ass whooped. That's just the end of it, right?
I would think so.
Anyway, we're going to keep going. They're good and drunk, and they go to the bar at the reception. And there's a service member there.
When we say they, it's the three guys, yeah, going off to Vietnam.
And they buy him a drink, but he seems really hesitant and resident. He doesn't really seem to be happy to be there, or maybe haunted. You're not quite sure. He does eventually take a little sip of the whiskey they buy him. The kids, I don't know what a better way to term this, the young men, are enamored with him.
See him, he's a Green Beret. They're about to go to Vietnam. They want to know how it is over there. And his response is, fuck it. And he doesn't want to say anything. Clearly traumatized in some capacity. They don't understand because they're excited to go off. You know, they get kind of upset with him because they're asking him questions and clearly he doesn't want to talk about it.
There's so much foreshadowing in this film. You know that this is a tragedy. You know what's happening as you're watching it. There's no question about it. So we're going to keep going. Streep catches the bouquet and Walken proposes to her and she says yes. But then it's kind of weird. And he's like, when I get back, not before.
Well, I mean, they're leaving in like 2 days. So.
Yeah, yeah. The bride and groom have a good luck for life challenge where they have this two cups with one handle. And if they drink it together and nothing spills, it means good luck for life. But the woman, Angela, spills a little tiny bit on her dress. And you're like, uh-oh, something's going to happen in this relationship. You had a little note here.
In this scene, there's a giant pile of gifts. I feel like we don't see that at weddings so often anymore. I don't know if it's because everyone just goes to their wedding registry and the gift could shift right to the person's house, or people just give cash these days. What's your experience? Like, do you think people are still getting like giant boxes of china?
I have been to weddings and seeing a table filled with stuff, but mostly it's gift cards. But you're right. Like, a lot of that doesn't happen anymore.
I mean, I think there's also been a shift generationally upon what people want. Back in the day, you would get 5 different china sets. I don't know why. Even my mom has like 4 or 5 china sets that she's trying to push on me. But I saw a thing saying that most wedding gifts these days are experiential. So people say like, can you send us money so we can go take a trip somewhere, as opposed to giving an object, because a lot of people don't need that 4th china set.
That first china set. I'm eating off paper plates. Are you kidding me?
So in this scene, the director asked the extras, who were actually all cast from that town that they're in, and our parishioners, to wrap a box so it looked like a wedding gift. And many of the parishioners didn't understand this, so they brought actual gifts wrapped and set them on the table. Before they went home for the end of the day, they had to sort that all out. So they had to go through all the gifts, tear the wrapping off, and give them back to the person that brought it. Just a note on the parishioners there. This is definitely a big party. All of this is real. They're all getting drunk on set. That must have been like a really good time for them too, because I think everyone looked like they were having a pretty good time there.
Yeah, again, jumping over that glass of beer. Amazing. But that's sort of the whole movie. Like, we haven't touched on this, but the first half is them just being drunk the entire time. They drank almost from the first second to when they went to Vietnam.
I think like they're having the time of their lives. Everything is great. And then they go to Vietnam and everything changes. It's like a real hard shift. And that's even how the film goes. It's a real hard shift to Vietnam. We'll get to that in 1 second. After the wedding, they actually get in the car to drive away. And they're like freaking bombed. I can't believe this. So I looked this up online just out of curiosity to see when drunk driving laws were really put into effect. Apparently, the breathalyzer was invented in the 1950s. Drunk driving laws have been in effect since basically people could drive cars. They really didn't get strict on the enforcement of it until the 70s. So probably about the time that this movie happened. When you see how drunk they are, it's like, this is insane to let them behind the wheel of a car.
Yes, absolutely. And maybe they were actually drunk. Who knows? This seems like the type of movie where like they're all into it.
You know, as they're sort of driving away, Michael actually gets out of the car, strips, and runs down the street naked. And Nick follows him. And once Michael finally stops, Nick gives him his coat because it looks like it's a little chilly out, and says, if anything happens to me over there, promise you won't leave me. And this is where we see some full frontal De Niro, if you wanted to know.
Nice. Excellent. Big old Bobby Milkschlong. Is this out of character for Michael?
How did you interpret this? It did seem a little odd to me.
It seemed like he was undergoing stress and this was him releasing that. Like, he built it up and built it up throughout the entire day. And then he just like had to let it go. And it feels like he's the type of person who will just let things simmer until one day explodes.
Gotcha. The stripping naked and running through the town when it's freezing cold out in the winter didn't make sense to me, though. But
yeah, all right. It's kind of a weird scene. It feels like it would be more Michael chasing Nick. It didn't ring true to the character.
Yeah. I think the next scene, I think, is also another thing that feels a little out of place because of how it's shot. So the friends go in their tuxedos onto their hunting trip. There's these scenes where they show up at the lodge. Basically, they're still in their tuxedos. You probably noticed this too. The mountain scenes look strange.
Yes.
Right?
Very strange.
Okay. And the reason for this, those of you that aren't from, you know, that area of the country, there's a giant fucking glacier in the mountain behind them. It doesn't make sense. That's because this was actually filmed in Washington State, where they have much, much bigger mountains. The reason for that is it was the wrong season. They actually filmed the movie in the summer in West Virginia, but they wanted snow in the mountains. And interestingly enough, in the scene, the outdoor scenes where things were filmed, they actually sprayed the trees with something to make the leaves fall off them so that it looked like the fall. And they gathered leaves from other places and put them on the streets and things like that. So we see the crew deer hunting now. And this is definitely their thing. So Dave, what would you do if you were to ship off to war? Is there like a thing you would want to do with your friends?
Well, I could tell you what I wouldn't do. I wouldn't climb a mountain.
Oh, I agree.
That's an inside joke.
Yeah, we climbed a mountain one time and all of us almost died.
Yeah, I got a kidney stone from it. I would like to go somewhere. I'm typically like a lake and cabin guy. Like, I don't like going to the beaches. I don't like going to Vegas. I just like hanging out in the woods where it's calm and not very loud and just screwing around. It'd be great to play like euchre with all the guys, you know, and just very low key.
Gotcha.
What about you?
I guess I don't have like a destination in mind, but getting everyone together to hang out for a period of time would be nice, where you could have a couple evenings just shooting the shit or whatever. You know, maybe go out to the bar if you want, and not a place that's very loud so that you could hang out and talk with people and kind of catch up. Where that is doesn't really matter to me so much.
Yeah. You sure you don't want to do a bunch of ayahuasca?
I mean, we could. I'd probably maybe opt for shrooms so I'm not puking.
Okay, I'm going to remember that. Next time we're all together, I'm just going to get a bunch of shrooms so we can just have a great time.
Well, Dave, funny you say that. They're trying to get that on the ballot here in D.C. to legalize mushrooms.
Excellent. You're going to have a lot of fun.
If we can't take a trip outside anywhere, we can take a trip in our homes.
I'm moving from the couch to take a shower, and it feels great.
Yeah. So when they reach the top of the mountain with their gear, Stanley realizes he's forgotten his boots. And Michael says he's not going to lend him a pair because this has happened many times before. It basically seems like Stanley's never prepared for any of these things and always relies on other people. Someone offers him a pair of boots, and Michael's like, you cannot give that to Stanley. Stanley has to learn a lesson. He's done this so many times. Finally, someone's like, you know, fuck you, Michael. Just give him the goddamn boots. It doesn't matter that much. I think that shows that Stanley's kind of not really all that together. Michael's probably annoyed with him, and it's probably a bit of a harsh reaction as well, I would say, but I understand. Yeah. I think we see a little tension within the group there, too. Nothing that would break the group apart, but in this scene, this is where we see the infamous Twinkie in the mustard.
Oh, the Twinkie in the mustard. Is this the most disgusting food scene we've seen in our Best Picture watch?
I can't really think of any other major food scenes. Like, do you have another one in mind that would even come close?
Absolutely not. No. I mean, I started thinking about Hannibal Lecter, but we don't actually see him make a meal or do something this weird. I saw this and it was like a WTF moment. I was like, what the fuck is this?
Well, they even call it out because he's like dipping it in there and like the whole group starts cracking out because they're like, that is gross.
I started thinking about this. They are hammered. They are shit-faced. They're drinking in the car. Yeah. They were drinking all night. This dude who did this probably has zero taste buds.
Just hungry.
Yeah, and I can tell you that from experience. One time when I was in WV, West Virginia, with our bud, I got shit-faced and went to like an all-night breakfast place and had cheese sauce and blueberries over pancakes.
Yeah, man. Why not?
I was wasted. I was like out of my mind drunk.
What's that? The Eaton Park?
Yeah, it was. It was the Eaton Park. Back in the day.
You want to pause and talk about that for 1 second too? So I feel like it's not the same, but we did spend a little bit of time in town similar to the one that we saw here.
Yeah.
Morgantown is much bigger, but has a feel that's similar to this. It's in the mountains. It's in the hills. The houses look the same.
Working class.
Yeah. I mean, like even the bars, I felt like the bars we saw in this movie.
Mm-hmm. I thought the same thing watching it. Yeah. I had the same vibe. I was going to mention this, you know, we're on a little bit on drinking. It was interesting when you said like they're having the time of their lives. But when I was watching it, I was actually very sad for them. I was like, oh, this is all that your life is. It's like you go to work, you get drunk, you go do something like bowling and you drink some more. And you're just like you're constantly in a state of being drunk where you don't have to really think about what's going on in your life.
They're not the people, I think, generally that are going to look too deeply at their lives, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole film, right? This is supposed to be about small town America and how the effect of the Vietnam happens. It's not like a rich kid goes and then that's not the story that's being told. So they bag a deer.
Yep.
Bang, bang. And a pretty bang, excruciating bang. Scene.
Part of this shows that both Michael and Nick and even Steve have familiarity with weapons. We see that Michael is a good shot. He kills his deer with one shot, as he does. There is sort of a close-up of a deer in distress. It just turns out that they tranquilized the deer. They filmed it. So there are no deer actually hurt in this film. I guess not killed. There's another deer hunting scene later. The deer in that scene is apparently famous because it also did some TV commercials. It's a well-known deer.
Okay, after that hour-long first act, building up these relationships, showing how everyone cares about each other, hard cut to Vietnam. Boom.
Yep.
Vietnam.
Boom. Helicopters. Explosions.
Yeah. People getting killed.
They're home, and then boom.
I've never seen a cut like this. Never.
So this was actually filmed in Thailand because they wanted to show something that looked geographically similar. There is a change in the camera work here. So the first act of the film, the camera frequently looks up at the characters, giving them a larger-than-life feeling. And moving forward, a lot of the shots are on the level with them or even above them. It's this physical shift that makes the characters feel a little bit smaller, changes your interaction as the audience with them as they face the horrors of war.
Interesting. It's a good technique. Again, it's just incredibly violent, incredibly quick. We see a Viet Cong soldier kill a local group of farmers in a very gruesome way. Michael is laying on the ground pretending to be dead. And when the soldier is distracted, he jumps up, grabs a flamethrower, and he torches the guy. Or very soon after, a couple of helicopters land, bringing additional troops. And coincidentally, there is Nick and Steven among the group. It's sort of like a weird reunion where Michael doesn't really say anything.
I mean, I think he's just been in combat and killed some soldiers, and these guys run up on him. Unfortunately, they're quickly overrun by some North Vietnamese soldiers and captured.
Just some notes here. Like, Michael is, I believe he's an Army Ranger based on his uniform later in the movie. He is a very highly skilled combatant, and his buddies appear to be regular soldiers. And I think that tracks with their personalities.
I think so.
There's like, there's just so many cuts with this scene so quickly because it's like they're in Vietnam, they're captured, and now they're in Russian roulette. Boom, boom, boom. Like all within 10 minutes, maybe.
And they're suddenly together again, too.
Yeah, yeah. And like a different film, they would have shown them going to camp and learning how to do all this stuff. And this one's like, no montages. Boom, done. You're in Vietnam.
I mean, I don't really think you need the montage, but maybe like just a little bit to give us a better setup to understand who they are and what they're doing over there, too. Because it's like Michael's suddenly there. And then, you know, what's the chance that he actually runs into his buddies? Like, probably not great, but it happens.
It's really abrupt. The three of them are captured along with some other people. They are forced to play Russian roulette for the entertainment of their captors. John, what is Russian roulette?
So for those of you that don't know, it is a game of life and death where someone loads a bullet into a six shooter. The cylinder of a six shooter spins it and then closes it. So you don't know where the bullet is. And then they put the gun to their head and pull the trigger. So you have five chances of not dying and one chance of dying. That sounds pretty intense to me. So that's not great odds, in my opinion. These guys are forced to do this. It's very traumatic for them because they're basically unsure if they're going to walk away. The Vietnamese soldiers who are watching this are gambling on this to both see if the men will crack or not. Because if they do, they get thrown into a pit where they will basically die. Or if they continue playing, they're likely to die also. Maybe even faster with a bullet to the brain. As I was reading about this, there are no documented cases of this ever happening in the war. Although the director insisted he read about this in a news article somewhere.
Bullshit.
I would say bullshit too. So no one can find any evidence of this happening. Once I learned that, it made the intensity of the scene a lot less.
Yeah, same. I read that after I watched the scene, because this is the most intense part of the film, this 40-minute Russian roulette escape.
And the most controversial. So I think this is also probably where those allegations from those different communist countries in the 70s were really offended, because this never really happened.
But Russian roulette is real and people do play it.
Yes, I read this article, a Darwin Award winner, if you will. Some guy thought it'd be a good idea to play this game, and he loaded his pistol.
Jesus Christ.
If you understand why that's different than a revolver, a pistol has a clip in it that always pushes the bullet into the chamber of the gun. So there's a 100% chance, unless the gun jams, of that person dying, and they died.
Wow. I was doing this reading on it, and it turns out that Russian roulette comes from an older short story. It did happen in Russia with people wanting to gain honor for a little bit.
That seems crazy to me.
Yeah, we're not Russian. I mean, you're Russian. I'm not Russian.
Well, I'm not doing that. So
that's definitely the most important scene. It's the most controversial. It is intense. Probably introduced Russian roulette to a lot of people, unfortunately. And as the scene goes along, Michael and Steven are forced to play each other, and Steven cracks and he pulls the trigger, but he has the gun pointed in such a way that it clips his head so he doesn't die. Because of that, he's thrown into a water pit and he will eventually die, and he just goes into shock. Next, Michael hatches a plan to escape, but it requires both him and Nick to play each other. They have to have 3 bullets in the gun.
Where am I?
I do 3 bullets.
Three. We do 3, huh? 1, 2, 3.
I'm too loud. Yeah.
Okay.
Come on.
Come on.
Come on.
Come on.
Come
on. Come on. Come on. Come on.
Come on.
Come on. Come on. Come on. Come on. Come on. Come on.
Come on.
It is incredibly stressful, because the entire time I thought one of them was going to kill themselves, and they do it. And Michael ends up with the gun with 3 bullets, kills 3 guards. Nick grabs a gun and kills another one, but takes a wound to the leg. Yeah. And then they go out, grab Steven, who is just an absolute wreck. Like, can't really think straight. He's in shock, and they float down a river trying to get to civilization on a log. So as this scene goes on, it's frankly a little long, I think it says that they go pretty far. They run into a helicopter that comes down low enough that they can get on top, and they get Nick inside, and Steven and Michael hold on. And as the helicopter takes off, it comes under fire, and Michael and Steven fall.
Steven falls off, and then Michael goes in after him. Nick makes it to safety, but Steven actually hits some rocks in the crash, and he breaks both of his legs pretty severely.
And Michael picks him up, walks through the jungle till he
barefoot.
Finds some. Yeah, barefoot. So he does a Herculean stuff. But we don't know that, right? So like, this film withholds information from you constantly. It's like trying to be sort of a mystery, because once the helicopter takes off, you don't really see what happens to Michael and Steven for a while. You just cut to Nick, who's in a hospital in Saigon, and he's just out of his fucking mind.
I guess I'm losing track of the order of things here, because you do see his broken legs.
You see him pick him up and start walking, and then it cuts directly to Nick in the hospital. And you're with Nick for a pretty good time. And then, then you jump back to Michael dropping off Steven. I said they ran into a Jeep. But there is like a long standing time where you don't really know what's going to happen. In my mind, I thought Michael was going to have to fight his way through the jungle, but they just skip all that.
So Nick, let's talk about Nick. He's definitely suffering from intense trauma. He's kind of despondent and doesn't want to talk to the doctor, who's asking him questions about different things. Do you feel like the doctor's sort of accusing him of being a communist?
Maybe not being a communist, but I think he thinks that Nick is fine and he should go back out. Like, they're not taking care of his mental health.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely not doing well. And Nick eventually, you know, back in uniform, probably a few days later, heads out into Saigon to get a drink, stumbles into this gambling den at a certain point, and sees people playing Russian roulette there. When he sees that happen, something triggers in him. He grabs the gun from one of the two guys playing Russian roulette, puts it to the head of the player, pulls the trigger, and then puts it to his head and does the same. I think clearly suffering from the trauma. I mean, he was triggered here. Then a fight breaks out and Nick is whisked away by a Frenchman who says, you know, if you want to continue to do this, and with a little bit of luck, we can make a lot of money.
Yeah. Let's dig into this a little bit, because my reading of it was that Nick is traumatized because he was shot and injured. He almost had to kill himself. And then he saw his friends disappear, because Nick doesn't know that Steve and Michael got back. My interpretation that he's like filled with guilt and trauma.
Yeah. Michael actually happens to be in the room of this game and sees what happens and tries to catch up to Nick, but fails.
Yeah. Can we talk about why Michael is there? That's the one of the things in this movie that bothers me, because I never understood why Michael was just hanging out in that room.
That's not really explained, I have to say. Maybe what we're seeing is that they're both, I don't want to say acclimatized to this level of violence and somehow still seeking thrills or looking to feel something, go to these events. I don't know. I mean, like, what's your interpretation here?
I mean, I don't have a good one. I would say that he is suffering, but it doesn't quite explain how or why. He's just there watching it happen, which seems somewhat out of character for Michael.
Or he's now he can face those things. I don't know. I feel like in some way, Michael's always this cool operator and can handle these things and is taking it kind of casually, I would say. Whereas Nick is still traumatized, and when he sees it, it sends him into this terrible mental state.
Either way, we don't know. I mean, we don't know. And if you have an idea, please let us know, because it would be great to get to the bottom of that. Here comes another hard cut. Michael goes back to the States.
It is true.
Yeah, this movie is filled with them. Smash cut. He grabs a taxi on the way home. He sees at his house that there's a big sign, a lot of people, and he gets nervous. So instead of going to the party, he goes to a hotel and stays and goes to his house in the morning and runs into Linda, who is still living there, and she is about to head off to work.
So why do you think Michael skipped that whole thing?
I don't think he wanted to talk about his experiences. He probably has some shame built up in him, because like, he doesn't know what happened to Steven or Nikki. You just don't want to deal with people who haven't experienced a lot of these things, who are going to ask you a lot of questions.
I think also he just, yeah, wasn't ready to socialize in that capacity. Having a bunch of people there is not what he wanted.
Yeah. So we learned some things in this. Like, first, Linda kisses Michael on the mouth almost as soon as he arrives. Not pretty close.
Do you think she does that, or does he do that to her? Because I can't just.
I think she does it.
Okay.
It's like an awkward scene. Really hard to tell what's going on in Linda's head. We also know that Nick has gone AWOL. I mean, no one knows where he is. There's a scene at a grocery store when, you know, Michael in his full regalia is just with Linda, and a woman who just happens to be like an extra kept kissing De Niro.
So this extra, this was not scripted. I think she just had a thing for De Niro, kisses him several times. The scene kind of carries on. she kisses him again at the end of the scene. This was just her doing, and they kind of just kept it in there.
Yeah. Can't wait to do that next time I see Chris Hemsworth.
I can't wait to see you do that either.
Come down here. You're real tall. So Michael flirts with Linda, and then she proposes that they quote unquote comfort each other. Michael really isn't interested, and he's clearly dealing with a lot of stuff.
I mean, I think he's also respecting Nick at this moment in time because he's not sure what has happened. But we learned that she hasn't heard from Nick at any point either. We do see a scene where Nick tries to call home, but the operator, I don't know if they were Vietnamese and like there was a language barrier, but for some reason he couldn't be connected to his small town back home, even though he tried. And then he just gives up. How do you interpret all that?
I don't know. I think Nick wasn't really serious about marrying Linda.
Oh, really? I felt like he would have done it, but I felt like too many things happened in Vietnam.
Like, I think he's a good guy and he probably loved her, but he wasn't like 100% serious, and he more got caught up in the moment at the wedding. So Michael eventually does meet up with his friends, and, you know, not much has changed there. They're still drinking. They're still happy. And he also finds out that Steve is back, but no one has run into him or talked to him. Michael then visits Angela, and that's Steven's wife. She's not doing great, and she writes down the location of where Steven is. This is a really kind of bizarre scene. Like, she doesn't speak at all. She just takes a pen out and scribbles where he's at.
Well, she's, like, traumatized. And yeah. She's clearly seen Steven again, and, you know, she's taking what she's seen very hard. And she's got a young son. Steven's not around, and we know from the beginning of the film that Steven's mom is not particularly fond of her, so she's probably dealing with a lot here.
Yeah.
It's just as hard for her as it is for Steven in some capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Not to downplay what happened to Steven, but, you know, his wife is also dealing with a lot here, too.
And so the remaining guys go deer hunting, and this time Michael can't shoot the deer. He feels a deeper connection, and at the last moment, he just doesn't hit the deer.
Yeah, does he even pull the trigger? I feel like he's just seen too much death and doesn't want to see anymore.
I don't think he pulls the trigger. I might be misremembering it, but I don't think he actually pulls the trigger.
Yeah, and then back in the cabin, we have another scene here. Michael walks in and Stanley's pointing his quote-unquote unloaded revolver at one of their friends. Michael grabs the gun and pulls the trigger, and it fires off in the air. He then shouts at Stanley that this isn't a game. He puts a bullet in the cylinder and spins it back to this Russian roulette thing, and then he holds it to Stanley's head and pulls the trigger. So very intense scene in Friends. That kind of ends the fun that these guys have.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think changes after that?
You learn not to fuck around with Michael.
And firearms. Maybe Stanley learned that he needs to quit fucking around with these revolvers and carrying them everywhere.
Hopefully so. But you never know. Stanley is just a prick. Like, I wish I had a better word. Like, he's the worst. So that happens. And then Michael and Linda have a romantic moment, is the best way I'm going to say it. She goes with him to his hotel, and it's clear that they were going to sleep together, but then he falls asleep, or maybe intentionally falls asleep, and then they just
sleep next to each other, I guess. Nothing happens. I still wonder at this point if Michael is unsure where Nick is.
I think so.
And maybe he doesn't want to step in or intervene.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is, like, he's at a hotel because Linda is at his house, and even though it's his house, it still was his and Nick's house. It feels like he is trying to distance himself a little bit because he's not ready to deal with everything that's happening. Even Linda says, being in a hotel is kind of weird. Eventually, Michael visits Steven at the VA, and we learn that Steven has lost his legs in the use of one of his arms. It's real sad. I feel like that's a tragic moment because you see it and you're like, oh, wow.
This is not even a combat injury, you know? This is like outside of all that, so it's even worse. You know, it could have been avoided probably.
Steven tells Michael that every month he gets a bunch of money from Saigon. And I think Michael understands that this is coming from Nick and that Nick is still in Vietnam. Michael decides to head back to Vietnam to fulfill his promise to Nick, and that is to bring him home.
Yeah, Michael also tries to take Steven out of the hospital. But Steven resists, saying he's not ready to go back to the real world. You know, how did you take that too? Because I felt like Michael was, I don't want to say unsympathetic. I think he didn't like the hospital experience, saying, like, you know, you don't have to live like this. You can go back to your old life. But Steven is clearly just, like, not ready to do that. Why do you think Michael's trying to push that on him?
Because Michael wants his family back. He just doesn't know how to put it back together. And Steven's a member of his family. And I think he would feel better if Steven was with people who he was closer to.
It's like some tough love and probably an inappropriate way.
But Steven's also going through a lot here. Like, misses both his legs. He can't really use his arm. His future is diminished in a lot of ways. And he has a right to be there for as long as he wants, trying to figure out what he's going to do. Could you imagine hurting yourself irreparably and then going to see your friends? Like, I think you and I would understand this because we come from a generation who are more open about our feelings. But like in the 60s or 70s, where men were quote unquote men, like they wouldn't talk about how broken they feel. You know, anyway, that was all that was going through my head when I watched that scene.
You know, a guy who works with veterans, like he's a vet himself, and his job is to help vets reintegrate into civilian life when they get back home. It's a real thing. It's like beyond just, you know, physical injury, it's hard to kind of switch from a really regimented lifestyle to something where you can kind of do and get away with whatever you want. There's no one telling you that you have to do or behave a certain way.
So Michael goes over to Vietnam and he tracks down Nick. And we find out that Nick is playing Russian roulette for money. The only way that Michael can see to talk to Nick is if he plays Nick in a game. So he organizes a game. He spends a lot of money in this scene. Like, he's just dropping money left and right.
I think it was the money that Nick sent back. You think?
That's a good point. I don't know. He gets a game between the two of them. And the idea is that Michael is going to talk Nick out of doing this and come home. But there's some things you see. Like, Nick is still despondent. And he also has track marks on his arm.
Do you think Nick is a willing participant in this? Or is he being coerced?
I think he's being coerced. I think he's mentally damaged and addicted to something. Probably doesn't feel a whole lot.
Michael and Nick play around Russian roulette as Michael tries to get through to Nick. Michael tries to bring up things from their past to try to get him to recognize him and kind of snap out of it. Michael puts the gun up to his head and tells Nick that he loves him. And then he pulls the trigger. And nothing happens. Michael walks away unscathed here. We actually see Nick break down and cry a little bit here. I think he starts to recognize what's happening. I wonder if Nick feels betrayed in some capacity, like Michael broke his promise by leaving him in Vietnam. You know, like, what do you think Nick is feeling at this point?
It's hard to say. He probably felt that at some point, but how do you feel betrayed when someone comes back? My interpretation of the scene is that he's mentally unstable, he's on drugs, and he's mourning the loss of his innocence.
And his friends, too. And I think he feels guilty because he was the one that made it out on the helicopter. Maybe didn't know what happened to the two of them.
Come on, Nicky. Come home. Just come home. Home. Talk to me. Nicky, just talk to me. Nicky. Wait a minute. Nicky, just do it to your arms. Nicky. You remember the trees? Remember all the different ways in the trees? Remember that? Remember? Huh? The mountains? You remember all that?
One shot.
One shot. One shot. Hey.
Yeah.
He was just done. He's like, I can't function in a world like this. Because he does. Nick says one shot. He puts the gun to his head and pulls the trigger. And he kills himself.
In this scene, you know, Nick, to have that many empty chambers come up in a row, you know, mathematically, do you think Nick allowed this to happen or wanted this to happen? Or did his luck finally run out?
I think his luck finally ran out.
I think he wanted to die, though.
I mean, I think he wanted to die, but I also think his luck ran out. Like, I think he would have just continued going until he'd finally died. It just happens to be he died when Michael was there.
Because it seems like when he remembered the trees and, you know, the one shot thing, it seemed like there was a moment where he's like, oh, I see that you're back for me. But then he ends it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it could be like he remembers the trees and he's like, I can never go back to being in those trees again. I can't go back to being a person I was, and I'd rather be dead.
Mm-hmm.
That's a perfectly fine explanation of it. And as the movie goes along, because there's a little bit left, Saigon falls. Michael hits home. And they have Nick's funeral. And after the funeral, they all go to the local bar and they have coffee and they get some beer to drink and they're all sitting around. They look stunned and it's a very muted affair, but there is some hope because Steven seems to be reconnecting with his wife and Michael and Linda are getting along and might end up together. I don't know if this is a coda or what to call it, but the movie ends with a very downer version of God Bless America being sung by the entire group.
Well, how did you interpret that?
I took this whole movie as them, or as the director saying, the Vietnam War was a mistake. And them singing this like very sad version of God Bless America, it sort of the punctuation, right? Saying like, mm-hmm. they learned that it's America isn't blessed. It is what it is. And death is random. And we're there for not for a reason. And their innocence is gone.
Yeah. And it didn't bless these people in any way either. It's like, mm-hmm. this is what happened because of America. I mean, the director did this very intentionally. I think as I was listening to the commentary again, the cinematographer, his initial reaction was like, this is dumb. This is not going to fly. But apparently it's a very memorable scene from the movie.
It's huge. It's probably one of the most memorable.
I'd totally forgotten about it from when I had first watched it. So I guess there's that too. To get into some of these things here, since Russian roulette did not happen in the war, I think it is a metaphor for gambling with the lives of these soldiers and men sent there by the U.S. government.
Yes, I do think that's an accurate interpretation of it.
Although the director, again, insisted that it did happen. I think this is kind of a...
It didn't. I mean, like, it may have happened, but you can't prove a counterfactual.
This interpretation is a revisionist interpretation of the script. And I don't think that was the original intent, is what I'm getting at. I feel like that was filled in later. Like, we came to this conclusion that it is, in fact, a metaphor, when I don't think that was the original intent.
Yeah, I can see that. I can 100% see that given all the stuff around the movie.
I have this question too. So could Michael be considered a supernatural being? Because at the start of the film, he talks about seeing sun dogs in the sky, which is a blessing to see this. And then throughout the movie, he's like incredibly lucky to the point where it doesn't make sense at how lucky he is. And his friends don't fare nearly as well. Every time he puts a gun to his head and pulls the trigger playing Russian roulette, nothing happens. Even when they load three bullets into the chamber, he kind of makes it out of the war relatively unscathed.
I mean, physically, not mentally.
Yes, but even mentally, I think he fares a lot better than other people. Is there something supernatural about him? Is he just lucky? You know, like, what is it?
I don't think he is. I understand what you're saying, because at the beginning of the movie, right at the beginning, when they come out of the steel mill, him and Nikki look up and they see sun dogs. It's just like, you can see three suns. It's like a version of a rainbow. And he's like, it's a blessing. But what's really interesting about that is that if it's a blessing, then both Nikki and him should have it.
There's other reasons why I say this too. Like, he does these heroic feats. His buddy falls out of the helicopter and breaks his legs. He follows after him. Nothing happens. Then he carries him through the jungle. There's a lot of things that this guy does that are incredible in so many ways. I guess that's why I'm kind of getting at this. I think you can interpret it any way you want to. I'm sort of making the case here that this is like the luckiest person on earth. If not for that, maybe he has some supernatural presence that we're not aware of.
I mean, the movie wants you to understand that Michael is blessed. I do think that. I think my interpretation is just that he is a very skilled and highly trained Army Ranger. Because of that, he's able to do these things. And that's because of his temperament. But you can have the argument that he was blessed. And because he was blessed, he made it through the war. Blessed with luck. And his other friends weren't.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting question. I'm glad you asked that. Because you can go either way with it. I wouldn't necessarily say he's semi-divine or divine. But he's definitely has something going on.
I mean, it's also just, you know, survivor's guilt. Sometimes people just make it through these things. And there's no good reason as to why it happens either. So.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to chat a little bit about themes?
Go for it.
I saw three major themes here. You know, love, friendship, and loss were the ones that I saw. I know that we could also talk about the vagaries of war. For me, this movie was all about loss and how you handle and deal with loss, and particularly the loss of innocence and how you change when you see horrible things. We talked about this the entire way through the film, how America's sending its kids to die. It's about friendships falling apart when people experience other things, which is a version of loss. It's a movie about loss. It's a real bummer. So why do you think this movie won?
I think part of it was timely. This movie came out just at the end of the Vietnam War. America was still dealing with that loss, and the soldiers were still dealing with their war experiences. So maybe the audience understood or felt some connection with the movie because they had experienced the same thing in some capacity.
I think that's one of the major reasons. Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think of, I mean, I don't really have a ton of supporting evidence for this, but this is what's in my head, is that probably the Russian government and communist governments not liking this film probably bolstered its prominence in some way. Might put it in the news like, oh, these countries hate this, but so if you're a red-blooded American, you should like this.
Right.
But what I think was probably one of the most important things that got overlooked about how this movie won is that it revolutionized the way studios marketed their Best Picture winners. From what I understand, when Universal, the distributor, thought this movie was going to tank. Think about it. It's a 3-hour long movie. An hour of it's just a wedding. It's a downer. They didn't know what to do with it. And they had this sneak preview in Detroit that just apparently bombed. People did not like this film in Detroit. He's a producer called Alan Carr, and he owed the producers of The Deer Hunter a favor. And they brought him in to act as like a consultant. Like, how do we get this movie out there so people see it so we don't lose money? What I read is that he came up with this stunt. And he convinced the studio to release the film on LA's Z Channel before it opened in theaters. And then he convinced them to only release the film in one theater in both LA and New York, just so it qualified for the Oscars. So it was like he was seeding influence because he knew people in LA and part of the Academy and for people involved in the film industry would see it and then talk about it. But you had to go to a specific location to see it. If I understand this correctly, because it feels kind of convoluted, is that he essentially got screeners to people. By putting it on this Z channel, he was getting screeners to everyone so they could see it and then build up momentum and have it spread to the rest of the country.
So what is Z channel?
It's a over-the-air channel.
He just broadcast it over the air?
Yeah, broadcast it over the air with the goal of like just getting eyeballs on it, which is a kind of a cool concept. It's screeners. It's like you're not going to go see this because it's 3 hours and it might be boring, but if you're like watching it at home, maybe you'll watch it. Like everything I read said that this really revolutionized campaigns.
I'm watching a few of the other films that were nominated this year. I still feel Deer Hunter is better than the other ones.
I'm going to trust you on that one because I haven't seen those. This is a long one, and I'm having a hard time concentrating.
Yeah. So winner or winner?
I think it's a winner. I was going into it. I didn't think I was going to like it. I do like it. I don't think it's a perfect film, but it is an impactful film. Is it a winner or winner for you?
I think it's a winner. I don't really feel like this is a must-see, though.
Interesting.
It feels like it kind of came together in a haphazard kind of way. Yeah, yeah. Like, it just worked.
We said we were going to talk about this, so let's actually do that. Do you think that a lot of luck was involved in this movie winning the Best Picture?
I mean, I do think it was better than the other films. I think a lot of luck happened in it coming together. The director seemed like a nut job, honestly, and was lucky to have really good actors, a script that kind of worked. It came together, I would say, maybe more accidentally than intentionally.
I mean, that's everything I understand of it, too. It's like you have a stellar cast and you have all these people who are really good at their job, and it elevated the material.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it was the director. I think it was everything else.
Looking back on it, how many phenomenal actors are in it? They hefted this on their back and they're like, this movie's going to be successful no matter what.
And they carried it up the mountain, like for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Porn parody name. Bow, bow, wow, wow. I call this the Derriere Hunter, John.
I was going to say two Russians, one cup.
That's real. That's 100% real.
Yeah, that actually happened in the movie. All right. So just a quick note. Should you buy the Blu-ray? I think the HDR cleanup looks great. So they spent some time on it. It looks really good. I don't know if you really need to buy the Blu-ray. The commentary is okay. You don't really need to go through it. And it also didn't come with the digital version. I don't know why. It's kind of annoying to me.
Lame.
Exactly. All right, Dave, any feedback?
We did. We've gotten actually a bunch of feedback all around one topic that we talked about in our last episode, and that was the Cavalcade episode. Okay. And within that episode, we were talking about champagne, and we were like, what's the equivalent of American champagne in terms of like, it has to be made in a region, and if it's in that region, it's something XYZ, and if it's another region, it's you know, ABC.
Mm-hmm.
I got multiple feedback from people who texted me and were like, bourbon, bourbon. There's a difference between bourbon and whiskey. The American equivalent is bourbon.
Okay. That makes sense.
It does. Just blanked. You guys are all right. You are completely correct. Chalk that up to just having a brain cloud. I don't know.
Too much champagne.
Too much champers.
I have to apologize, Sarah Arkwright. I felt like that was one of our most boring episodes because I didn't really like that movie. I don't know how you felt about that. I tried to listen to the episode and was like, no, don't care. Like, I don't know how you felt about that.
So yeah, I listened to the whole thing. I mean, I listened to it because I recorded it, but I also listened to the edited version. It was an incredibly difficult episode to put together, and I completely understand why you're saying that. I mean, part of it is that the material wasn't good, and it also wasn't interesting. Like, sometimes when you watch a really bad movie, you can, like, point to something like, this is so absurd that you can laugh about it and talk about it. But with this movie, it was, like, just competent enough that you can follow it, but not bad enough that it's good, and not good enough to be excited about. It was just such a bland movie. And there's a reason why it's considered one of the worst movies of all time with in regards to the Oscars, too. Like, right. I get it. And I guess on top of that is that there's nothing to talk about. Like, I did so much research trying to find stuff to talk about, and there's nothing. There's just nothing there.
I mean, this is like that saying, you know, lipstick on a pig. And I feel that way about this movie. No matter how we tried to gussy it up and make it interesting, it was never going to be interesting.
Not at all. Not at all. Yeah, I appreciate that you mentioned that. I'd rather be honest with our audience. You know, it was okay. It was not my favorite episode.
No, you don't have to listen to that episode, and you don't have to watch that movie. Let's just say that.
Okay, great. So next up, we are going to go a little bit lighter. This is going to be great. We're going to do the dramedy, The Apartments. A man tries to rise his company by letting his executive use his apartment for trysts, but complications and a romance of his own ensue.
Exciting.
I'm excited. This is one that I've pitched a couple times, so I'm going to be happy watching it, and I'm glad that we're going to do something fun. Cool. And it's also 2 hours, unlike, you know, a couple movies we've been doing. So if you want to get a hold of us, you can email us at david@awardwinners.com. or john@awardwinners.com. You can also follow us on Facebook @awardwinners or on Instagram @awardwinners. We are more active on Instagram than any other social media, so feel free to check us out there.
Thanks for listening to us. We will catch you again next time.
Happy hunting.